Hello, everyone. Welcome to Better Health While Aging, a podcast that gives you strategies and information about improving the health and well-being of older adults. We discuss common health problems that affect people over age 60, the best ways to prevent and manage those problems, and we also often address common concerns and dilemmas that come up with aging parents and other older loved ones, like what to do if you're worried about falls or safety or memory or even the quality of a senior's healthcare. I'm your host, Dr. Leslie Kernison. I'm a practicing geriatrician, so that means I'm a medical doctor specializing in geriatrics, which is the art and science of modifying healthcare so that it works better for older people and for their families. Today's episode features a special guest, and I'll be speaking with Janet Benvenuti, an expert on family caregiving and helping older parents. She is the founder of Circle of Life Partners, which provides educational seminars to help families manage aging issues. Professionally, Janet began her career as a scientist, and then, after attending business school at Harvard, she became a pharmaceutical executive and helped to launch the quality movement in the United States. Her deep interest in aging and caregiving emerged from her 10-year experience caring for her own aging parents while in her 30s, and from navigating a variety of health and aging and sibling challenges along the way. In 2010, she published a book titled Don't Give Up on Me, Supporting Aging Parents Successfully, which she describes as a case study rather than as a memoir. It's an engaging and insightful read, and so I'm thrilled to have Janet join me today on the podcast to share some advice and insights that can help other families anticipate or manage aging and caregiving challenges. Janet, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Leslie. I'm delighted to be with you.
So your book describes your caregiving journey, including how you came to be so deeply involved in your parents' care. And I certainly hope people in the audience will read it. But just for to get us started on our conversation today, could you briefly summarize what the situation that you found yourself in with your parents and how you ended up helping them?
Sure. Before I jump into that, Leslie, I think it might be helpful to tell the listeners where I'm going with this. In a few minutes, I'm going to share with everyone an exercise that's tied to understanding how to more effectively work with your siblings. I know for a lot of folks, unlike me, who live geographically distant from their parents and even from their siblings, it's a real challenge to figure out how do you effectively create a network of support for them. So that's where I'm going with this. And the reason I mention it is I'd like everyone to have a piece of paper and a pen or pencil, because we're going to sketch out some things in a few minutes. For those also who are listening, who are planning for their own longevity, The issue of siblings is really about how to create a network of support. And so this exercise that we're going to get to will help people really understand how to build this community of support around them as they age. So back to my story. My own journey with my parents began, like for so many of your listeners, with a telephone call and a medical crisis. I was working from home one day when my dad called asking for help. He had learned that morning that a pain in his side that he thought was caused from pneumonia was actually lung cancer. After calling the hospital to schedule the surgery, he decided that the diseased lung would be removed. He reached out to his attorney and then he called me. And he wanted to know if I would help my mother out paying bills and such. And to be very honest, I didn't pay any attention to that. I said, of course I will. But I immediately focused on the issue of cancer, as I'm sure you've seen with your own patients, and was trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to take time out of work? I had two children. They were 6 and 3 at the time. And that was my focus, certainly for the first few months, was helping him and my mom get through this surgical procedure. And then when he came home, making sure that they were properly cared for. Well, weeks turned into months, and a few months into it, I actually read the documents that he and the attorneys had crafted. And what I realized is that I was now legally responsible for a 78-year-old living with cancer and dying from it. It was stage 4 lung cancer. And a 77-year-old, my mom, who was living with both heart disease and also had dementia.
And so can you briefly tell the audience what were the documents he had completed? Was that a durable power of attorney or was that something else?
Yes, no, there were two documents. And in fact, you've talked about this in other podcasts, but I think it's helpful to understand them completely because when we get to talking about roles that people play, on the health side, he signed two documents. One is called a HIPAA authorization form. And the second one, in Massachusetts, it's called a healthcare proxy, but across the country, it's called a medical power of attorney. And so those documents have different uses. As you know, the HIPAA authorization form doesn't actually get a lot of attention, but what that did is it allowed his physicians and healthcare providers to speak candidly with me about his medical issues. And the same with my mom. Without that in place, legally, doctors can't talk to adult children. As you know, if you were my physician, even my husband couldn't have a candid conversation with you about what was going on with me unless I signed a HIPAA authorization allowing that to happen.
Well, just to briefly for the audience, you can verbally give the doctor permission to talk, and it's better if it's in writing. And then I think it depends on the state, but in California, often if somebody has completed a durable power of attorney for healthcare, they can check off whether their power of attorney can participate now or only once they're incapacitated. And so at least in my state, that's often enough for many clinicians to speak to family. But it's a very good idea to have both to cover your bases, and people should always check and see what's necessary in their own state.
That's right. And I actually have an app for this because anybody over the age of 18, if you have a child going to college, they need to have signed the HIPAA authorization form. So, okay, and the second document that he signed was called, appointed me as their healthcare agent. He signed it and my mother signed it as well. And as you know, a healthcare agency has to be triggered when someone loses their capacity to make medical decisions on their own. So my father, you know, could make his own medical decisions even through the end of his life. But in my mother's case, because of her dementia, I actually began making medical decisions in concert with her physicians. Mm-hmm. About 3 years, actually, before she passed away. So this role of overseeing their health as a very practical matter, most of us don't pay any attention to our parents' lives until we have to. But once they asked me to support them, then I began to establish a relationship with their physician. And I have to be honest, Leslie, it didn't go well at first. And the reason was their doctor had made a mistake. He prescribed a drug for my father that actually caused him to hallucinate. And once that happened, we had to use a different physician to wean my father off of that. And from that point on, I decided to the extent that I could, I was going to go to their medical appointments and sit in on their appointments. So the first session was really very awkward. I mean, if you can imagine what this looked like, my mother and father are sitting in front of the desk of the physician before they were going in to be, you know, evaluated. And I'm sitting there with my back against the wall, very quietly trying to take notes and just be this sort of fly on the wall. And my dad started down his list of questions. And at one point he looked up and he said, "Oh, by the way, Doc, we brought our mother with us here today." So we tried to make it the awkwardness a little less awkward. But that was something that I began doing. And today it's even easier. I know there are some physician groups who allow adult children to FaceTime into meetings. So in those days, you know, we didn't have iPhones. It was a few years back now. And so it was a little more difficult, but to the extent possible, my goal was actually to understand what was going on with them, to make sure I understood the medications and that, and to establish a relationship with their primary care doctor. And we wound up, after many years of working together to care for my parents, he was absolutely one of the reasons my mother was able to stay at home with us through the end of her life. He became a real advocate for her and was very helpful in helping me understand how to take care of her. I'm sure the same way that you do with your patients' families.
Well, I think it's wonderful that that your parents were able to have you coming with them earlier rather than later, because often adult children or whoever becomes the person who starts overseeing that healthcare or making some of those healthcare decisions, often they only start coming relatively late, you know, when they have to be there making the decisions. And it's a little bit of a missed opportunity to have that time of overlap. So it's wonderful that you were able to go. But it's true, it can take a little getting used to for the clinician, because they may not be used to having somebody asking additional questions.
And it's also a little awkward for the parents. I mean, obviously, right. Now I was poking into their private lives. And, you know, that was a little awkward. I mean, I mentioned earlier, we haven't discussed it. I'm one of five children. And it's different, you know, helping them get to medical appointments than actually going in and being part of the conversation with the doctors. It's not unlike what we do with our children, but it's a little awkward when you begin to make that transition with your parents.
Well, it's an adjustment. Yeah. I mean, I do encourage people sooner rather than later to just go with a companion, because it's a good idea to have someone else who can hear what the doctor said and help make sure you had your questions answered. But, you know, when that person is your adult child, I think, you know, it raises all these dynamics that people have to sort out, this, you know, evolution of the parent-child or parent-adult-child relationship.
Exactly.
You know, which also takes some thinking through. So to come back to how you helped your parents, as you were saying, once your father was diagnosed with that cancer, he signed documents and giving you the power of attorney for health, and also, I think, a durable power of attorney to manage affairs.
That's
for
right.
Him and for your mom. And then ultimately, he died of his cancer. And then you oversaw the care of your mom, who had dementia, until she died at home.
Yes.
Is that about right?
That's right. And the durable power of attorney that was signed, and there are actually two ways to structure things with regard to somebody's financial matters. One is to create a durable power of attorney. The other is to create what's called a living revocable trust. In their case, the durable power of attorney was the right choice. And what that meant was that I could pay their bills legally, pay their bills, file their taxes, even sell their house, which I did eventually do, whether or not they were cognitively aware of what was happening. Because that's what the word durable means, that it continued all the way through that responsibility until the end of their lives. This is a really, really important power that you give to someone. Because think about what I could do. I mean, I basically stepped in and took charge of their wealth. And I use that phrase very lightly because they were people of very modest means.
But their assets.
Their assets, exactly. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to folks, I say there are two decisions that have to be made. Who's going to oversee your health and who's going to oversee your wealth if you're not able to do that? In my family's, my parents' case, and in many families, there's someone in the family who's good at this, you know, paying bills and all the rest. And I'm one, and all of my siblings could have done this role. In families where there isn't someone whom either you trust or who has the ability to do this, whether it's because of time or skills, you can set up a trust with a trust officer, and someone who has financial experience can actually mm-hmm. pay bills and that. It doesn't happen with frequency that people rely on a trust situation, but it's usually someone in the family who plays this role of just making sure that parents are not, that they're consistently paying their bills, and quite frankly, that they're not a victim of scams.
Right.
But that's a subject that we can get to if we need to.
Yeah, well, we could come back to that later. But I think similar to what you were saying about that it can be good to have your adult child or somebody start coming to the medical visits sooner rather than later, I think likewise, it can be good to have that collaboration with the finances sooner rather than later, so that you have kind of time for everyone to get used to it and get to know it. And that can probably has advantages over people stepping in a time of crisis, assuming they can step in and have a power of attorney to do so.
Exactly. And think about it this way, you know, Leslie, if you asked me to play this role for you, I would have to know a lot of basic things. I'm basically stepping in to help run your life. You know, do you have a checkbook? Do you have savings? Where are your investments? Do you have health insurance? Do you have life insurance?
Right.
You know, are you a veteran? Do you have veterans benefits? There are all kinds of issues. And it's like stepping into running someone else's household. Well, you need time to get up to speed. And the good news, the really good news, and this is the first third of the book, I show what happened as I began to assume these new responsibilities. And it isn't always smooth sailing. Just as the doctor wasn't totally thrilled to have me in the room at first, my mother wasn't thrilled to see me touching her checkbook. So attorneys will say, oh, set this up as if this is easy to do. In practice, it's not easy. You know, power is shifting in a family. Mm-hmm. Elders are losing control. A lot of times they really resist help. So I give my father and many elders real credit to be able to think this through and begin this process of allowing someone to help you. It doesn't mean they have to take everything over, but being, my father had this expression, he would say, you have to grow old gracefully. You know, being willing to allow your family members who truly want to help you, help you in a way that doesn't disrupt everybody's lives. It's a little tricky, but more often than not, families figure it out and everything goes more smoothly. And as you're saying, to do that before they're in the middle of a medical crisis, the opening chapter in the book is a medical crisis. And I let the reader see how totally chaotic that is. You know, my father's dying in his living room. My mother's upstairs making the beds. I had a child who had to be picked up from preschool or kindergarten in 45 minutes, and he needs a ride to the hospital. So in that moment, I'm not talking about money or healthcare documents or any of that. We're just, you know, you drop and run, and that's what it looks like. So the more that we can, both for our parents, but also everybody who's in their 40s and 50s and 60s, the more that we can begin to put these documents and make sure we're thinking this through for ourselves, the easier it's going to be to age without a lot of disruption.
Right. Well, I know that this is a large part of the work you do now, and so I want to hear more of your insights on this topic. But before we go into that, just coming back to your story, you mentioned briefly that you were one of five siblings. I think you were the youngest.
That's
and
right.
You'll have to tell us in a moment also just how many years you ended up quite so involved in your parents' care. But in reading your book, I was just struck by the fact that it seemed quite clear that the work of caring for your parents was not anywhere close to evenly divided among your siblings. And it seemed that you and your sister, who I think was the next youngest, really did the lion's share of it and shared a lot of it. Although even there, I don't know if you would say it was 50-50 or not. But I was kind of struck by that dynamic. And so I was just wondering, why do you think that happened, that you and your sister Ginny ended up taking on so much more and the others less? And how did that make the two of you feel? And, you know, how did you sort of, what kind of conflicts and tensions came up with your siblings? And how did you resolve those?
Well, every family has, a unique dynamic. So in my family, the oldest three felt that after my father died, my mother should move into either assisted living with a memory unit, which frankly she couldn't afford, or a nursing home. And they were in different stages in their lives, and there were lots of reasons that none of them wanted to own my mother. My sister and I, perhaps because we were younger, perhaps because we were We had seen what happened to her when she was in institutions of care. She was tied to chairs. She was totally mistreated. Because we're only 2 years apart. We have six children among us. We're those folks who just think, oh yeah, sure, this will work. We'll do this. We'll keep her at home. Somewhat it was out of naivete at the beginning.
And I'm sorry, you mentioned your mother being tied. If I remember right, she had had some mental health issues, I guess, earlier in life, which you and your sister were remembering. Is that what you,
yes,
what you meant?
Yes. There were a whole, she had lived with depression that was untreated. And so she was very mishandled. And again, this began when I was 21 and my sister would have been 23. We didn't actually know much at that point, but my sister has a doctorate in education. She has a couple of masters. She has worked with children and adults with disabilities since she was 13. And her husband works at a psychiatric hospital. So there was absolutely nothing that my mother would do that they hadn't seen and understood how to support. And on my side, I took my father's request very seriously. He asked that she be taken care of in her own home through the end of her life. And my father never went beyond high school. And you mentioned my background. The five of us share 13 college and graduate degrees. And there was a piece of me, and every person has their own response to this. There was a piece of me that felt my job was to protect her. And if we could set it up so that she would be cared for at home through the end of her life, then I was going to try to do that for her. And so my sister Ginny is really the heroine of this story. She said, Mom can live with me. Now, she has four children. She has four daughters. Three of them were teenage girls at the time. And I don't think I have to say any more than that. They had a home that had one bathroom, one shower, six people, two working parents. It was not a house that was structured to take in a woman who has dementia. So we had to build a small apartment onto her house. And it happens that one of my brother-in-law's builds custom homes. So again, my father died suddenly. This housing issue became a huge source of conflict because it wasn't set up in advance. And now my mother passed away years ago. I've educated tens of thousands of people at this point. This housing question comes up in every family. Will your parents stay in their own home through the end of their lives? Will they move to something like an apartment or an assisted living community or what are called life care communities? Or will they live with one of their children or another family member? If you listen to the senior housing folks, you think everyone moves into assisted living. They do not. 89% of people age in their own home or with a family member. So it's really difficult to take care of someone with dementia at home. It's not something that I suggest people do. But because of the unique situation with my sister and I and the kind of skill sets we have, we just figured we would try. And that's what we did. But that issue, the middle section of the book is all about the chaos. And it is, in fact, because I put it in there because we hadn't done some good forward thinking about housing. And that came back to haunt us.
Mm-hmm. So in the end, how many years did this go on that you and Ginny did this work of caring for your mother with dementia at home? And I feel like a lot of people would sort of resent their siblings who weren't in the day-to-day like that. And how did you cope with that? Or did they pitch in helping with the finances or find other ways to contribute?
The length of time was 4.5 years from the time my father died until my mother passed away. As you know, I'm one of five, and I have a cousin who's like another sister to me, and my parents had 16 grandchildren. So in the book, I stripped out a lot of the fun part of our lives during this time because the book is intended to be instructional. And so we had family gatherings. We had graduations and, you know, at weddings and so forth. To be fair, my sister and I probably at that moment, I can't speak for her, but I can speak for myself. There was some anger that the older siblings weren't doing as much. There was frustration. We were exhausted. I mean, we were working, we were taking care of children ourselves, and we also were juggling the demands of my mom. And someone with dementia, you know, takes basically it's a lot of work. And we wound up, because when we realized that they might not pitch in as much, we wound up bringing in help, home care. So I had sold her house. And again, everything that's in the book was done on her money, not on mine. And so it's doable. I sold her house. I used the money to pay for home care. She went out 3 days a week to an adult day health program. And again, that was a fabulous choice. I never would have sent her there. My sister set that up and I was a little irritated at first. I thought, what? We're sending mom to daycare? What is this? But it turned out there, it was a fabulous center. She was there doing lots of activities. There were nurses who supervised her and provided her with medication. She was literally there the day she died. I said to the nurse at one point, is there any time when you are not going to take care of her that it would become too much? And she said, no, this is what we do. As long as you want to use us.
Wonderful.
There are 4,800 adult day health centers across the country. They are a low cost option for families who are living with someone with dementia. They provide food, they provide activities, they provide nursing supervision. And if you're trying to keep someone at home with a spouse or a sibling, or in our case, our mother, it is, it's a wonderful resource to use. And many people call it their club. They're going out to their club for the day. And the hours are only, they're not so great for working mothers or working daughters, because the hours are only 8:30 to 3:30 typically. But again, it gave her an opportunity to socialize with people. And also we had a woman who is 69 years old, who is a widow, who also became someone who was involved in my mother's life, because my mother was physically very active. She could run up and down stairs without holding the railing at 79. And she was great fun. She just needed to be supervised. Until the illness advanced, she was able to go out and about. And my house never looked so clean when she lived with us that first year, because she loved to clean. And that's how I kept her occupied, so that I could get some things done. But yes, it was difficult. And you should expect that no matter how close your relationship is with your siblings, this is a challenging window of time. And it's important to understand the kind of roles that people play, and to think objectively about how to build this network of support. And so I think it's helpful, Leslie, now if I run people through the exercise that I'd like them to do, because this will make it really clear. So what we're going to do is we're actually going to draw a family tree. And I have a piece of paper in front of me, and I'm doing this as I talk. So I'd like you to do it as well, all of you who are listening. So in the center of the page, I want you to write your name. And then on either side of your name, write the names of your siblings. So in my piece of paper, I have two brothers and two sisters. So they're on the horizontal next to my name. And I'm also adding my cousin's name, because she's like a sister. She grew up with us. And if you have step siblings, put them on that horizontal line as well. So I have six people across the center of my page. Now, above my name, I'm writing the names of my parents, and you should do the same, and write the names of your step-parents if you have them. And then if you have grandparents still alive, you can put them at the top of the page. Then under each name, and you may need to finish this after you stop the podcast, write the names of your children. And then under each of your siblings and step-siblings, write the names of your nieces and nephews.
Okay.
After you map this all out, next to all of your names, put your any spouses or partners' names. So again, I have the six of us across the center line in my page, and then I have all the spouses because we were all married. So now my mother and father had 12 adults, right, who were part of the support network, plus their 16 grandchildren, a few of whom were married. Now, this is independent of where everyone lives. So this is your first exercise, is map out the family tree. Why? Because the entire health and elder ecosystem in America is designed around the expectation that it is the family who's going to take care of the old, the young, and the disabled. So the entire system is designed around it. All resources are geared toward this. So again, if you are a baby boomer or you're, you know, a Gen Xer and you're are unmarried or you never had children, you may have siblings. I mean, this is the same kind of exercise. You want to map out all the people who are in the nucleus of care. You may have longtime friends who are like siblings. We have our biological family, and then we have the family we've acquired over the years. So again, these on this page right now are people who are at the center of your life. Now, after you map this all out, the second step is I want you to think about the skills that each one of these people has. The skills. You are a physician, Leslie. I am 100% sure that in your family, you're the go-to person for medical questions. So when I described what my sister Ginny's experience was, on paper, it made no sense for me to even think that my mother could live with her, right? She's a working mother. She and her husband are both working. They had four children, two dogs and a ferret. What was I, crazy to think that my mother could live there? But her skill set and her husband's skill set was totally geared toward being able to sort of unemotionally and somewhat professionally take care of a woman with dementia. So it made perfect sense from a skills point of view. And then, of course, the issue was, how are we going to get a little apartment built? And my brother-in-law happens to build homes. So there was an issue of very objectively looking at the skills. And some of the skills are not just the professional ones. The younger of my two brothers is an absolutely hilarious person. He is so funny. He walks into a room and he's like the mayor. He knows everybody within a few minutes, and he tells jokes and stories. And my dad was like that too. Every Thursday morning, he would take my parents out for breakfast. Every Thursday. Mm-hmm. Now, was he taking them to medical appointments? Was he dealing with the drugs and all the rest of it? No, but he had a role to play. So if you think about the skills, you know, you have people who like to cook, and you have, so think, map this out in a skills basis. Now you begin to see, okay, how are we going to take care of folks? Let me give you some examples from some of the clients. I had a call from a woman whose mom was in a rehab, and and the family was privately paying $500 a day for the mother to stay there, which was ridiculous. So, and the dad lived, you know, 2 miles away, and he was still working there. He's in his 80s. And so the problem solving was, how do we get mom out of there, get her home, and set her up with a higher quality of life in a lower cost situation? And so I said, let's get your siblings on the phone. So we did. Every time I talk to siblings, the first thing I ask is, what do you do? What do you do for a living? Now, they think I'm being chatty and conversational. No, I'm actually trying to figure out what skills exist in your family. Because if you're going to care for elders, not for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, but 25% of elders will need support for 5 years or longer. If you're going to care for people for a long period of time, this is not unlike raising children, right? You're in it for a long haul. You need to be able to do this in concert with everything else going on in your life. So if I were your sister and I had a medical question, that wouldn't disrupt your work life, Leslie, for me to ask you that question. I have a sister-in-law who is a physician. I did ask her over a Sunday dinner, so what's going to happen to my mother, you know, with Alzheimer's over time? How do people die from that? So that didn't disrupt her life. It was just a quick question. So the issue is you're building a team or a network or a community, use whatever word you want, a community of support, some of which you may pay for, but not all of it. Depending upon the wealth of a family and the dynamic within the family, there are all kinds of options. There are tens of thousands of resources in America that are free of charge. So, you know, part of the work that I've been doing for the last 15 years is, first of all, understanding where those resources are so that every family and every elder, whether they have a large family or not, whether they have a network or not, that people are cared for properly through the end of their lives. So it begins by sort of this objective mapping out of who's available, who does what. Now, what happens? This is an exercise that you can work on for a bit. What happens if you have a brother or a sister who does nothing? You asked about how people feel as they're in this stage in life.
Well, there are some who do nothing, but I feel like the complaint I hear more is that they're doing something, but it's so much less than I'm doing. But yes, give me your advice for both of those.
Okay.
Because I feel like there's the nothing, the ones who are almost entirely checked out. And then I think, you know, more of in a way your situation where it didn't seem like your three other siblings were doing nothing, but it did seem like it was a lot less time and effort over the several years. And so I was sort of wondering how that, you know, how you had negotiated that with them. And also, you know, did your father talk to the five of you before and think about sharing this kind of effort of supporting him and your mom during their last years equitably? Or is it more common for parents to just pick one who seems more interested, more willing, has the right skill set, and put it towards that one, and that one tries to get, you know, some help from the others as best they can or according to the others' skill set? So yeah, give me some thoughts in response to that.
So first of all, I think it's completely unrealistic to expect every person in a family to share the load equally. That's not going to happen. And, you know, part of what I do in conversations like this and elsewhere is dispel some of the myths. There is always going to be one or two children who, because of their geographic proximity, because of their inclination, because of the roles that they've been asked to play, who will potentially bear more of the responsibility. And geography is a determinant of who's going to be dealing with the day-to-day issues. So if your parents live in Florida and you work in the Bay Area, and you're that designated child, that's the phrase I use, you're going to be flying back and forth to Florida. So what happens is either often people age together as a couple, and then when there's a widow or a widower, the person left standing is often relocates closer to one of their, to that designated child or their designated children. So let's dispel the myth that it's going to be equal. It's not. And that, once you hear that harsh reality and you let that settle in a little bit, then you begin to lower your expectations and move the conversation to, so who is going to be there to help? Because then you get into the problem solving around how do you build this network of support. It can include longtime friends of your parents. It can include members of a faith community. I know the congregation I'm part of has a group of people who actively support the elders within the congregation, actively support them. There are virtual retirement communities now where people can, they form networks online with younger individuals who live in their community. So the 50 and 60 year olds are supporting the 70 and 80 year olds because a lot of the support in some cases just involves transportation or making sure that people are fed, there's Meals on Wheels. So it isn't shared equally. What I challenge siblings to do, because I will only work with a family if all the adult siblings get on the phone or get in the conversation. And what I do is try to encourage the ones who live geographically distant that if they're not there to support the parents, their job is to support the sibling who is doing this work. So what does that mean? One fellow who lives in the Bay Area, his sisters were on the East Coast supporting his parents. One of the sister's sons was looking at colleges. Now, this poor woman was swamped with work, two ailing parents, teenagers, and all that. And he knew a lot about colleges. And so I said to him, your job is to help your sisters schedule your vacation to travel east to give them a break so they can get away on vacation, help your nephew look at colleges. I mean, take some of the tasks out of their lives so they have more time to spend with the parents. And to be truthful, most siblings, once they understand that they don't have to be there 24/7, that, you know, we divide it all up and you divide and conquer. Once people realize that, people slip into roles and they see that they can do small increments of support or small tasks that really do make a big difference in the lives of the children or the nieces or nephews who are there sort of when dad falls down a flight of stairs.
Right. Now, we know that often, but not always, it's a daughter or a woman or daughter-in-law who takes on that designated child role. And we also know that women often lose income or have to cut back on their work to do some of that help for an older parent, especially in the later part where there's more sort of heavy lifting, as it were, and a person needs more than just help with chores or transportation. So some people sometimes work out personal care agreements.
Yes.
Where they might be paid out of the parent's assets or sometimes by their siblings to cover their effort doing a lot of that work. And I was just wondering, do you have a lot of experience with those? And what's your thought on those as an approach that siblings can sometimes take, especially if the designated child is having to cut back on work in order to help parents?
I absolutely think that, you know, we're talking about the arrangement among siblings to say, you know, we're going to pay you or you're going to take some of dad's or mom's assets because you're doing the yeoman's work here. That is absolutely an option. But let's not forget that the elders themselves can set things up even legally. So the adult child who is doing this work, and it can be somewhat unnamed, but they'll be compensated for their time. So it isn't just the siblings work it out themselves. It's also the folks, again, you have many people who follow you who are baby boomers or Gen Xers planning for their own longevity. This is something you need to think about. I also, though, Leslie, just want to make sure your listeners realize that there's a myth that this is a woman's issue.
Right.
60% of the caregiving is done by women. Which means 40% is done by men. 50% of Asian American men, for example, are involved in caregiving. So they just don't talk about it. Women, we talk about it, right? I published a book about it. I wanted to share my story, and I continue to share information because this is a huge issue. 10% of people will quit their job or retire early. 15% of people will take a leave of absence. The reason I do this work is because I saw that data in 2002, that the issue of aging and aging parents, you know, we talk about leaning in when you have children. You haven't seen anything yet until right. you get to the parent side. You have, but your audience hasn't. So part of the work that I do offline is working with executives to make sure they're beefing up their employee assistance programs and their employee benefits. You see, Deloitte just started offering a 16-week paid family leave. This is a huge issue. And in within individual families, as someone who's aging myself, I've thought about this. I have built into my estate plans that there's compensation, because if my daughter has to stop working, or my son, or cut back, then is it fair for them not to be compensated for this? And again, among siblings, there are siblings who provide financial support to the sister or brother who's close to the parents, because they really appreciate the fact that their sibling has stepped out of work or has shifted from full-time to part-time in order to be able to support their parents at right. home. So yes, these personal care agreements, you don't see them as often now with the baby boomers who have taken care of their parents. But because this has all been sort of new, most of the elders today who are in the 80s and 90s, they didn't expect to live until their 80s and 90s. They didn't have long-term care insurance policies. There are lots of things that just weren't planned for because no one expected to live so long. But longevity is here to stay for at least the next couple of generations. And so baby boomers and Gen Xers are really thinking this through for themselves.
Mm-hmm. So on that note, actually, you know, I think you've mentioned to me in the past that, you know, certainly by the time a person is 70, they should have a game plan for their aging. And part of your book is about how especially your father taking certain steps early on himself really helped and ended up making the work you did a little bit easier. So siblings can work it out themselves, but it clearly makes a difference if people lay some groundwork for themselves and their aging. So can you talk a little bit about what you recommend to people that they do as part of this game plan and preparing to get themselves and their family through this stage of life?
Yes. The first thing is that you want to get the legal planning in place, which means that you need a will, you need to have a HIPAA authorization form, you need to have a medical power of attorney, and also durable power of attorney. And again, depending on the situation, some people establish trusts. Oftentimes, people put these documents in place, and if they're married, they don't talk with their children about them. Mm-hmm. So we need to have conversations, open conversations about the legal planning, so that all the siblings have a sense of, you know, who's going to be in charge, because that's an issue. One of the reasons I wrote the book the way that I did is that it's actually used as a communication tool. You know, you can read this and see what happened in my family and then talk to your siblings about it. And, you know, I'm finding a lot of boomers are buying it and giving it to their children saying, hey, let's talk. What if I lose my ability right. to sign my name? Here's how I want things to play out. Baby boomers are a lot more aggressive about this than the previous generations. The second, so you want to make sure the health and wealth issues, the legal issues are buttoned down. The second thing is to make sure you have the right medical system. find a great doctor. You're a fabulous doctor, Leslie. We know this. You are. Yeah. But how many geriatricians exist in this country? Very few. We have a lot of fabulous primary care physicians who are totally stretched for time. You know, getting into the right medical system, establishing a relationship with a physician. There are so many wonderful physicians out there, and there are some that are not so great with elders. And so making sure that you have a medical support that is going to carry you through the end of your life well.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to add something briefly there, because I do see that there are more and more senior clinics, they're called, or just primary care clinics that have kind of designed themselves particularly to meet the needs of older adults. And they're not, many of them have geriatricians, but some of them don't. But I actually sometimes tell people, you know, that's a good idea too, because often they've sort of set up infrastructure to anticipate and help with a lot of common problems that come up for older adults. And often getting good medical care is not just about the skill and ability of the individual physician, but it's about what kind of clinic and system they're embedded in. So I've been encouraged by there being more and more of these primary care clinics that say they're designed for older adults. And I feel like that's, you know, another possibility people can look into.
Absolutely. You know, a friend of mine runs a group of clinics called Care More, and they are totally geared toward people who are 65 and older. They provide dental care. They actually clip elders' toenails. I know that sounds crazy, but a lot of times people get infections.
Little things can make a big difference.
And,
yeah.
Right? So there are all these, you know, it's really a lot of it is about preventive care, or just focusing on things that contribute to wellness. When you read my parents' story, what you see is we focused on, you know, making sure they were well fed, making sure they were surrounded by good humored people, making sure they got the right medical care, but they weren't over-treated. And so I found, with no offense to you, Leslie, that nurses, a competent middle-aged nurse is worth her weight in gold. And licensed social workers who similarly have a lot of experience with the resources that exist to support elders. That when I talk about a medical system, I'm talking the same way that you are, that it's not just your doctor, but also, are there nurses in your life? Are there social workers whom you can access through your local council on aging, for example? So there are lots of resources that are out there that are free of charge. I mean, obviously you pay for medical services. So making sure the legal life is buttoned down, making sure that you have a good medical setup, thinking through the issue of housing.
Tell us more.
Okay, so a lot of baby boomers are downsizing, and they're moving closer to the center of town. I just spoke with a woman who's in her late 60s, and she has two daughters. She's relocating closer to one of her daughters, and we were all on the phone together chatting about the details. And one of the things I suggested to her is buy a condo or get an apartment within walking distance of everything, the library, the grocery store, the post office, because at some point you may, first of all, keep you healthier, but secondly, you may lose your ability to drive, or you may not want to drive. And being able to walk to the grocery store is both healthy for you, it allows you to maintain your independence, but it also alleviates some of the challenges with people living isolated, where they have to rely on others to transport them. So thinking about your own home, could you live there if you used a wheelchair?
Right.
Do you have handrails in the shower? Is the lighting good? I have all kinds of materials that I send to people. I have a document that shows sort of how to set up your house to make it safer. 40% of hospitalizations are caused by falls. So just simple things like that. And you just did a wonderful webinar on fall prevention. So there are lots of ways to think through your house. Are you in a neighborhood? Do you have friendly neighbors, or is everybody gone, you know, working and that? Thinking it through in terms of, can you live there if you were blind? Could you stay in your own home if you had serious medical issues?
So kind of thinking forward a little bit.
If these
changes happen, these kinds of declines or impairments, and many of the ones you're mentioning are quite common, you know, how would I manage in the home I'm in right now? And would it be, you know, I guess it sounds like you suggest that people really assess where they're at and consider whether they'd be better moving elsewhere.
And do it when you're young. And by young, I mean in your 60s and 70s. I have a woman I point to as a role model. She actually helped me co-found Circle of Life Partners. And she is She was married, and sadly her husband has passed away, and she did not have children, but she has a wonderful relationship with her nieces and nephews. She decided a few years ago, because she's now in her 70s, she decided to look into one of these continual care retirement communities. Mm-hmm. She signed on to one. She sold her house. She's in a townhome. She has a service where she's not going to live in this community for probably 10 years or more, but they have a service where she's connected to a nurse coach. She can go to this community and participate in their exercise classes and some of their activities. And so she said, as much as I adore my nieces and nephews, I don't want them to be responsible for caring for me. So she's probably 5 or 6 or maybe even 10 years younger than the age when most people think about this. But she said, and all of her friends are somewhat surprised that she decided to set herself up in this way. But she's being extremely proactive about this issue of moving or creating a situation where there will be people around you to support you. It's interesting to see people relocate to Florida or they go to Arizona, and that's really fabulous for your 50s, 60s, 70s, maybe into the early 80s, but then all your friends die, all the people around you, and now who's going to be there? There was just an article about the two best places to live or retire to are Naples, Florida, and Barnstable County on Cape Cod in Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
However, those criterion that were used to select the best places to be an older person did not include the density of people between the ages of 40 and 55, because those are the folks who are going to be there to support you. So if you are living in a place that is highly skewed toward elders, well, who's going to be there to support you? It's younger people, right? So the whole idea of intergenerational living, there are lots of options today that people are exploring. And so in your 50s and 60s, this is the time to seriously think about it, because you can make changes and move to a new situation and still establish friendships and get connected into a faith community if that's important to you, and volunteer and get to know people in the community. So we talked about legal issues. We talked about making sure you have the right medical setup, making sure you're thinking through housing. And the other issue for me is really focus on health and wellness.
So you mean on taking good care of yourself right now, and also maybe getting up to speed on any chronic health conditions you have so you can make sure to take care of them as well as possible? Is that what you mean?
Exactly. So the work that you're doing to create online resources of information of how to manage diabetes or how to prevent heart disease from advancing and so forth. These are really important bits of information that just anyone can absorb. There are 6 things that contribute to longevity. It's already proven. Genetics is one, which controls 30% of how we age. We can't really control that, although the genomics work is heading forward on that. But there are 5 other things we can control. We can control what we eat. We can control our exercise. We can pay attention to our sleep habits. We can surround ourselves with people. And again, some folks, and myself included, I like my alone time, but I am surrounded by kooky, fun-loving people who love to laugh. And as you age, you know, these folks will boost your spirits, and that boosts your immune system.
So important.
And the other thing is to manage stress. You know, Leslie, that people who have an active faith practice, for example, recover more quickly from illnesses and surgeries. And that's because prayer is a form of meditation. And meditation boosts, you know, lowers your cortisol level and boosts your immune system. So having a practice, whether it's yoga, whether it's meditation, whether you have a prayer practice, something that can lower stress, listening to classical music, going for long walks, anything that we can do as we age to try to keep the stress out of your life. And that's the role I played for my father and mother. Once I signed on to do this work, and trust me, at first I had no idea what I'd stepped into, I literally took the stress out of their lives. My father's life expectancy was less than a year, and he lived for 2.5 years. And I like to think that part of that was because I and my siblings and their grandchildren, we surrounded them with activity and food that was appropriate, not too much. And all the stresses of life, you know, whether they could get to the doctors or not, whether their bills would be paid or not, filing those tax returns and so forth, all that was taken off their plate. So they could just focus, as children do, on living in the moment and living. And to the extent that we as our adult children, or we as nieces and nephews, or we even as neighbors and friends, can help the elders around us have less stressful lives, that's going to boost their longevity and give them a higher quality of life. And that's, to me, why it takes a community, it takes a village to take care of elders.
Yeah, it does help to have a number of people, because I have had some patients who were in their, say their 60s, who, you know, were struggling to help a parent who was in their 80s, you know, or early 90s, and who I felt were getting a little bit caught between the stress that caregiving was taking on their own health at the age they were at. These were people who often had chronic conditions, but these were people often who didn't have a lot of siblings. And I think their parents had a smaller network than your parents did. So I think, you know, for some people it's a sort of different form of sandwich, I guess, where they're kind of sandwiched between their own health concerns and the concerns of their parents. But yeah, it sounds like people can do a lot just by planning ahead, by working on setting up that support network and the documentation, the legal documentation to allow people to step in when it's necessary, can go a long way to choosing the right community to age in, and then being proactive about taking care of one's health. Those are all like great ideas. And hopefully more and more boomers will be implementing them. People do often seem to have trouble making that game plan. Do you have any particular suggestions for, you know, on how to overcome those? Or for, I often hear, you know, adult children a little frustrated because they feel their parents haven't addressed this type of planning. What do you suggest on that front, and any last tips or resources to share with the audience?
I would suggest a few things. The first of all, I would suggest that you do get a copy of my book. And I don't say that all proceeds are used to support elders. People get the paperback version, and because they pass it around to siblings and to people in their book club, and to use it to open a conversation.
I have a copy, and having read it, yes, I agree. I would endorse it to the listeners and say it's an excellent read and resource.
And you know, you can get it on my website, which is, I'm sure you'll do a link, the colpartners.com, or on my blog, which is don'tgiveuponthem.com. It's less expensive than through Amazon. But the reason I suggest this is that it actually will provoke a conversation. One of the first questions that you can ask your parents is, would you mind if signing a HIPAA authorization form so that if something happened to mom, I mean, play them off against each other. If something were to happen to mom, dad, and I needed to talk to her, you know, physician, the doctors would not be able to talk to me unless you signed this. That's often an opening question. What I also would say is, don't give up, I hate to use that, but don't give up on having these conversations. I tried to ask one relative to relocate. I spent 11 years with my mother-in-law trying to get her to move out of her home, 11 years. And she finally did at the age of 88. So sometimes you'll have a conversation, your parents seem to be pushing back, and they're not open or receptive. You know, wait a while and have it again.
That's a great point. It is a process.
Absolutely.
Not expecting everything to happen quickly.
Exactly.
You know, little by little.
Yeah. Right. There are a couple things. So get that HIPAA form done. I have an app for it. You know, it's there's an easy way to do it. You don't actually need to use an attorney to craft the HIPAA documentation or the healthcare agency. So there are simple ways to do it. Again, my website has some information about this.
Yes, I'll definitely put some links to that in the show notes.
And folks can also, on my end, join the Circle at Circle of Life Partners. We have newsletters. We invite people to events. We try to share information about what's happening around the country. And folks really, again, like yours, Leslie, I'm constantly sending people to you, and that's just going to increase. We need to continue to share the trustworthy resources. There are lots of online services. Some are good, most are useless. Each community across the country has hundreds of resources for folks to draw upon. So the more folks like you, Leslie, I'm a huge fan of yours, can convey information to what I call the average family, the more we can share. So how do you create these documents? What really does matter? What can you ignore safely? How do you find the right medical communities? Who can you trust? It's important that we all work together and
support each other.
And support each other.
Because almost everybody is going to go through this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And baby boomers get it. I mean, they're not clueless. They have been through this with their own parents.
Right.
But we need to do more, because where my parents' generation had 7 potential people for every elder, this next generation is only have 3. So we do need to have better understanding through our friends, through our communities, on how can we support all the elders where we live and work. And so I consider it an honor to do the work that I do. I've been at it for a very long time. And I have focused on finding the professionals, physicians, attorneys, financial advisors, and others who feel the same way that I do, and you are one of them, Leslie. That's why I've sort of kept in touch with you over the years.
Well, thank you.
Because we need to amplify the voices of people in the know. And understanding how to navigate medical issues is really a black box or a black hole for a lot of people.
And I think people like you can teach others so much, you know, once people have gone through it. I think it's wonderful that, having been through this, you're using that now to help so many other families. Well, Janet, it's been an honor and a real pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much. I hope to share many of the resources that you have on your site with the audience. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leslie.
And with that, I'm going to wrap up this episode of Better Health While Aging. If you have any questions about something you heard in this episode, you can post it on the show notes page for the episode. I'll also be posting some links to some of the resources that Janet mentioned in the episode. To find the show notes, visit betterhealthwhileaging.net and click podcast in the main menu at the top. Last but not least, if you've been enjoying the podcast, don't forget to support us by subscribing on iTunes. And if you've already done that, please leave a rating and review. This makes it easier for others to discover our show in iTunes, and I would love for the many people who are interested in health or aging or family caregivers to be able to find it and give it a chance. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dr. Leslie Kernison, and I'm looking forward to you joining us for future episodes.